Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. But you boogle hush and listen and mischief.
Welcome back to Voice of the Troubles, stories from the Irish conflict. We'll continue where we left off with William and Deirdre. For the pikes must
be together. Usually you would have been used to just getting a bit of a thumping, and sometimes it would have been worse than others. They usually try not to mark you around the face. You know, it'd always been nearly in around the body that you'd have got the thumping and the booting. They try not to mark the face. But that day, for some reason, they just became very vicious. I don't know what the reason was for it. I was saying that there were some who did say, he's got enough, leave him alone. But there was a few there who just were bent on continuing doing what they were doing. I got a bit of a beating, and then they threw me into a thorn hedge. Now, every time I tried to get out of the thorn hedge, they would tromp me further down into it. Now, I can still remember it as clear as day, because I actually thought, I did think that I was going to die that day, for there was not much pain, and there was not much bitterness in some of the ones that was there. And, you know, they wanted me to say stupid things like up the IRA, you know, that I supported the IRA, and all these sort of things, and I refused to say what they were looking for me to say. And there was actually a Catholic man that stopped, and only he stopped, I don't know what would have happened. For I can still remember the man, the car stopping, but for I was down in the hedge at the time, and well, most of them run away except for a couple of them. They didn't seem to care. And the Catholic man asked them what did they think they were doing, what sort of animals were they. And he got me pulled out of the hedge and got me to the doctor. They spent, I'd say, about 3 hours taking thorns out of me. And a few cuts as well where they had been kicking at me. But they spent about 3 hours taking thorns out of me. And they didn't get them all out that day. They got the main ones out. But there was wee thorns as well, which would appear, you know, a few weeks later and things like that.
And I think it's the first time we were allowed to protest. I remember all the children, the guys who were interned that night, all held placards, you know, release my daddy, and, you know, where is my daddy? Because nobody knew where they were. There was, it's either 10 or 11, nobody knew where they were. And they eventually told us where he was, and my mother and I went up to see him in Crumlin Road Jail. And I'll never forget this sight of mine. I remember two prison guards giving me Valium, holding me, and my father was so badly beaten, and he was in a British Army uniform, and I mean, I went hysterical, and my mother was crying, and just his eyes, you could just see the tears in his eyes. I think he was just that delighted to know that we were alive, you know, because when he was wherever they were torturing him, they had doctored a photograph of us all dead in the hallway, and says to him, somebody just lost their head, Mickey, we're sorry, thinking that he would talk. Do you know what I mean? They had told him that. They showed him a photograph and says, look, somebody went off their head, us all covered in blood, lying in a heap in the hallway. And my daddy always talked about that. And when he seen us walking in, the tears, you know. And, but I mean, that was horrible seeing him, because you couldn't even touch him because there was wire up. It was horrible. But there was like 10 or 11 of them singled out and tortured. They had bags. They're called the hooded men because they had bags over the head the whole time. They were naked. They had to stand spread-eagled with their knuckles and on their tiptoes, and got beat. And if they fell, they were put back up and beat again. They would vomit into the hoods. They had shafts of brushes inserted in them rectally. Yeah, Charles, there's not one of those men alive today. I mean, what that torture did to them physically, never mind emotionally, was unbelievable. Like, they were told their families were dead, being hooded and taken up in a helicopter and throwing them out, and they're really only 10 feet from the ground, but they think they're 500 feet in the air. But I mean, I remember it was 3 months later and we got a phone call, he was being released, and my mommy says to me, run down and tell Charlie Morrison, quick, your daddy's being released. We were dancing. He didn't show up for 2 days. And we're going, what the hell's going on here? He wasn't released at all. It was only somebody in the prison, one of the guards, pulling a prank.
Just because he would not tell the names of his brave comrades and the things they wish to know. Torn informer, oh, we'll kill you.
Kevin Barry answered no.
People say time heals. You learn to live with things, you never forget them. Like I can still tell you where I was, and that's 31 years ago nearly, what I was doing at 5 to 8 on the last Saturday of August 75. I was standing talking to the girl whenever the men come along to tell me that I had to go home. I was in a wee hall called Cross Keys. It was a social. I wasn't too old at that stage, I was only 15. My father was, he was a quiet man, but he was a careful man as well. But mostly when he was coming off duty or going on duty, for some reason or another, he had this notion that while he was in his civilian clothes, that like he didn't even carry his personal weapon while he was in civilians. He didn't believe in carrying his personal weapon. And he finished work on a Saturday night about 8 o'clock, and he was reversing out of the gateway whenever the gunmen come through, they're holding the hedge for the scene, the boys coming. But unfortunately, the only thing he could do was lock the door, where if he had his weapon, he could open fire on them. And they tried to kidnap him first half, but they weren't fit to take him out of the car, so they end up, they just shot him. The reason his hands and all were smashed with the butt of the rifles, where they beat at him with the butt of the rifles to try and get him to let go of the steering wheel. Now, unfortunately, they told me that my father was alive, that he had survived. So it was bad enough getting the shock in the first place, but whenever I got home, I expected him to be alive and in the hospital. But my mother, whenever I had done, I said to my mother, "Well, how's he keeping?" She says, "What do you mean, how's he keeping? Sure, he's dead." So it was like a double kick. I suppose the men thought they were doing best by leaving it to the family to tell us, but at the same time, you thought you got over it, or not over it, but you thought you'd got the news and then that he was okay, and then to be told again, and then like, you only start. The problem with our people up here in South Armagh, we never got the chance to grieve, because there was that many murders happened. Like there was another murder the next night, and the next night, well, matter of fact, the next night they tried to come into our wake house, the IRA did. There was upwards of 14 gunmen, and only the army put off shamilies, which is like flares, because at that stage we lived in Newton Hamilton, and they ended up chasing the IRA as far as the border.
You're in the street swinging a lamppost and the Brits are coming over harassing you. Do you know what I mean? No matter what you did as a child, you were harassed. We have a great saying today. We'd say, she's an old woman's head on her shoulders.
Like from when I was 12 on, I learned to deal with things that most people should never have to deal with. And my father actually told me before, a couple of days before he was killed, that he believes there's going to be a lot more men killed, and that I'd have to grow up pretty quick. I didn't realise how quick he was talking about.
You know, you had an old man's head on your... You walked around with the knowledge that an old man should have, not what a child of 3 or 4 should have, you know? You know, and that's a very big saying at home, because that's how it was.
You were living in fear all your life.
That total terror, you know? That sick feeling in your stomach and just that total terror, you know? I don't even know how to... Like, you're afraid if you swallow, you're going to be sick, you know? If you swallow, you'll vomit, you know? It's just a feeling of dread, you know? And thank God it wasn't, you know, I don't mean that to be disrespectful, but thank God, it wasn't any of my wee sisters or my mama, you know, at the time, you know? And then you feel guilty about that too, you know, because you're like, thank God, and then it's somebody else that you probably knew and loved, and, you know?
People that I stand talking to shot dead beside me, our mothers coming over and landing, and only by the grace of God you had moved a few feet and you survived. Sometimes an incident happening was a relief, if that makes sense, because you realised that an incident had actually taken place, so you had a bit of breathing space where there wouldn't be another attack for at least a few days anyway. So you realised that yourself or your family or your mates or whatever, none of them going to be killed at least for a few days.
Deirdre left Ireland in 1984. She is now living in New York. She has 3 boys. William still lives in Northern Ireland and started an organization for the victims of the IRA. He has one boy. After a lifetime of conflict, the wisdom to emerge from Ireland is one of caution.
Well, creating conflict, you need to be very, very careful in what you're doing. I know there's situations where they believe that they're going in to help people. It just doesn't stop when you've won the war. You've won the battle, you haven't won the war.
Whether it's in Ireland or elsewhere in the world, when the facts are disassociated from conflict, when you take away the politics and the accusations and the justifications, all that's left of conflict is this thing that breeds its own destruction and plucks people from time in its own accord.
I heard a thud, and everybody who had been in the Baleen was dead. Police officers from all walks of life in Northern Ireland, both Protestant and Roman Catholic, were in that canteen, and they all were killed.
Being killed arbitrarily and in a very violent and very sudden way. Mostly young people, though not all of us. For those years, that was a daily occurrence. That someone who you knew, someone who you may have left just a moment or two beforehand, someone who you were going to meet, in my case, a number of family members, and so on, you got word that they had been killed or bombed or shot or in one or two cases beaten to death. So that would be my abiding memory just of the... I remember when my father-in-law died, and I went to his wake and to his funeral. I remember remarking at the time to my wife that this was the first funeral of an old person that I had been at, that all of the other people had been in their early 20s and young people, that this was an old man who died.
Conflict doesn't distinguish between just and unjust or right and wrong. It can only meander over the landscape. In absolute randomness.
I heard it on the television. That was the first news I got of my husband's death, was that the minibus was shot up coming home from Glen Arm. I was setting the table in it for dinner for him coming in, and the television was on. And I had two wee granddaughters, and they were waiting on him coming in, for they had got new dresses for a wedding. My daughter was to be married in February, and they were waiting. They wanted to show them to Granda, so Granda never saw them. And I was getting invitations in and death cards on the same post.
But conflict doesn't just hover in the distance, waiting. It seeps into people's lives, into the very fabric of daily living.
You have a daily routine, and everywhere you go, you check your car. You sort of check your doors before you go out to make sure they're not booby-trapped. You go out, you examine underneath your car, you actually get down, look underneath your car, examine in underneath the wheels of your car, your wheel arches, to make sure that no bombs have been planted. Now, you live like that for whatever number of years you have to. If you're taking children in the car, you can imagine your thoughts, your fears, how many officers and various people has been blown up in a car accompanied by a child. Can you imagine how you would feel that if you were the lucky one and you were still alive and your child was blown to bits on the other side of the car. Can you imagine what that would be like? How it would affect your whole life? This is a daily routine. You don't socialise, because if you go out unaccompanied and you are chatting to people in a bar, chatting to people in a dance room or something, they're going to ask you, what's your name? Where do you work? You certainly don't want to tell anybody where you work. You don't want to tell anyone which area you live in, because that person could end up, you could be taken away and beaten up somewhere. I mean, these things are still happening in Northern Ireland. That yes, it does have an effect on you. You become withdrawn, you don't trust people, you don't want to tell anybody anything about you, you don't want them to know your name, you don't want them to know where you live. And this is all imposed on you. This is not something that you create yourself.
Conflict is universal, and it preys on our very humanity.
Everything going into slow motion.
Slow motion. You go into autopilot. The one thing that you think about is on how to survive.
A survival instinct takes over, and sometimes that saves a person's life.
And you crawl into a little ball. You know, you get down and cover your head, crawl into a ball and try to survive. You try to survive what's happening.
Christ was indirectly telling them, why should you obey Caesar at all?
No, a Christian wouldn't do that. No, I don't think I would agree with you in that one.
And it isn't through charity, it's just as part of our common humanity, have a responsibility to help other human beings.
And I'll be honest, they have not earned my forgiveness.
Once created, conflict will brew long past its perceived lifespan. The creators of conflict are arrogant in their presumption if they think that they can control it. Because conflicts last, chuckle at the world, and is how it raises the next generation.
You stop being a child. You just stop being a child. You lose every part of your childhood. When I look at wee ones today in the TV and I see them in Iraq, I just want to take them all and just... You just think, my God, I hope. Like, I look at my kids here, and them growing up every day, 6 days a week, it was the ballpark, football, baseball, let's go swimming, Mom, let's do this, Mom, let's... Loved it. It was in my glory. You know, they were able to have that as a childhood. In conflict, you don't have that. Because you're born, and then you fight, and that's it.
Voice of the Troubles, a Second Window production. Reported and hosted by Charles Lane. For more information, photos, and a podcast of the entire program, visit us online at www.secondwindow.org. Musical credits can also be found online. They are The Jolly Beggarman, The Brobdingnagian Barbs, Mark Gunn, Anuna, and Ray Fisher.